Chapter 32. Stupidity and ignorance. All the compassion in me was aroused in his behalf. I said to myself, when he comes to be examined again, he will be flung over, of course, so it will be simple a harmless act of charity, to ease his fall as much as I can. I took him aside, and found that he knew a little of Caesar's history, and as he didn't know anything else, I went to work and drilled him like a galley slave on a certain line of stock questions concerning Caesar which I knew would be used. If he will believe me, he went through with flying colors on examination day. He went through on that purely superficial cram, and got compliments too, while others, who knew a thousand times more than he, got plucked. By some strangely lucky accident, an accident not likely to happen twice in a century, he was asked no question outside of the narrow limits of his drill. It was stupefying. Well, although through his course I stood by him, with something of the sentiment which a mother feels for a crippled child, and he always saved himself just by miracle, apparently. Now of course the thing that would expose him and kill him at last was mathematics. I resolved to make his death as easy as I could, so I drilled him and crammed him, and crammed him and drilled him, just on the line of questions which the examiner would be most likely to use, and then launched him on his fate. Well, sir, try to conceive of the result. To my consternation, he took the first prize, and with it, he got a perfect ovation in the way of compliments. Sleep. There was no more sleep for me for a week. My conscience tortured me day and night. What I had done purely through charity, and only to ease the poor youth's fall. I never had dreamed of any such preposterous result as the thing that had happened. I felt as guilty and miserable as the creator of Frankenstein. Here was a wooden dashhead whom I had put in the way of glittering promotions and prodigious responsibilities, and but one thing could happen. He and his responsibilities would all go to ruin together at the first opportunity. The Crimean War had just broken out. Of course there had to be a war, I said to myself. We couldn't have peace, and give this donkey a chance to die, before he is found out. I waited for the earthquake. It came. And it made me reel when it did come. He was actually gazetted to a captaincy in a marching regiment. Better men grow old, and gray in the service, before they climb to a sublimity like that. And who could ever have foreseen that they would go and put such a load of responsibility on such green and inadequate shoulders? I could just barely have stood it if they had made him a cornet, but a captain, think of it. I thought my hair would turn white. Consider what I did, I who so loved repose and inaction. I said to myself, I am responsible to the country for this, and I must go along with him, and protect the country against him as far as I can. So I took my poor little capital, that I had saved up through years of work and grinding economy, and went with a sigh, and bought a cornetcy in his regiment, and away we went to the field. And there, oh dear, it was awful. Blunders? Why, he never did anything but blunder. But, you see, nobody was in the fellow's secret, everybody had him focused wrong, and necessarily misinterpreted his performance every time, consequently they took his idiotic blunders for inspirations of genius. They did honestly. His mildest blunders were enough to make a man in his right mind cry, and they did make me cry and rage and rave too, privately. And the thing that kept me always in a sweat of apprehension was the fact that every fresh blunder he made increased the luster of his reputation. I kept saying to myself, he'll get so high that when discovery does finally come it will be like the sun falling out of the sky. He went right along up, from grade to grade, over the dead bodies of his superiors, until at last, in the hottest moment of the battle of down went our colonel, and my heart jumped into my mouth, for Scoresby was next in rank. Now for it, said I, we'll all land in Sheol in 10 minutes, sure. The battle was awfully hot, the Allies were steadily giving way all over the field. Our regiment occupied a position that was vital, A blunder now must be destruction. At this critical moment, what does this immortal fool do but detach the regiment from its place and order a charge over a neighboring hill where there wasn't a suggestion of an enemy? There you go. Apostrophe, I said to myself, this is the end at last. And away we did go, and were over the shoulder of the hill before the insane movement could be discovered and stopped. And what did we find? An entire and unsuspected Russian army in reserve. And what happened? We were eaten up. That is necessarily what would have happened in 99 cases out of 100. But no, those Russians argued that no single regiment would come browsing around there at such a time. It must be the entire English army, and that the sly Russian game was detected and blocked, so they turned tail, and away they went, pell-mell, over the hill, and down into the field, in wild confusion, and we after them. They themselves broke the solid Russia center in the field, and tore through, and in no time there was the most tremendous rout you ever saw, and the defeat of the Allies was turned into a sweeping and splendid victory. Marshal Canrobert looked on, dizzy with astonishment, admiration, and delight, and sent right off for Scoresby, and hugged him, and decorated him on the field in presence of all the armies. And what was Scoresby's blunder that time? Merely the mistaking his right hand for his left, that was all. An order had come to him to fall back and support our right, and instead he fell forward, and went over the hill to the left. But the name he won that day as a marvelous military genius filled the world with his glory, and that glory will never fade, while history books last. He is just as good, and sweet and lovable and unpretending as a man can be, but he doesn't know enough to come in when it rains. He has been pursued, day by day and year by year, by a most phenomenal and astonishing luckiness. He has been a shining soldier in all our wars for half a generation. He has littered his military life with blunders, and yet has never committed one that didn't make him a knight, or a baronet or a lord or something. Look at his breast. Why, he is just clothed in domestic and foreign decorations. Well, sir, every one of them is a record of some shouting stupidity or other, and, taken together, they are proof that the very best thing in all this world that can befall a man is to be born lucky. The captain's story. There was a good deal of pleasant gossip about old Captain Hurricane Jones, of the Pacific Ocean, peace to his ashes. Two or three of us present had known him, I, particularly well, for I had made four sea-dash voyages with him. He was a very remarkable man. He was born on a ship. He picked up what little education he had among his shipmates. He began life in the forecastle, and climbed grade by grade to the captaincy. More than 50 years of his 65 were spent at sea. He had sailed all oceans, seen all lands, and borrowed a tint from all climates. When a man has been 50 years at sea, he necessarily knows nothing of men, nothing of the world but its surface, nothing of the world's thought, nothing of the world's learning, but its ABC, and that blurred and distorted by the unfocused lenses of an untrained mind. Such a man is only a gray and bearded child. That is what old Hurricane Jones was, simply an innocent, lovable old infant. When his spirit was in repose, he was as sweet and gentle as a girl. When his wrath was up, he was a hurricane that made his nickname seem tamely descriptive. He was formidable in a fight, for he was of powerful build and dauntless courage. He was frescoed from head to heel with pictures and mottos tattooed in red and blue India ink. I was with him one voyage when he got his last vacant space tattooed. This vacant space was around his left ankle. During 3 days he stumped about the ship with his ankle bare and swollen, and this legend gleaming red and angry out from a clouding of India ink. Virtue is its own R'd. ... There was a lack of room. He was deeply and sincerely pious, and swore like a fish woman. He considered swearing blameless, because sailors would not understand an order unillumined by it. He was a profound biblical scholar, that is, he thought he was. He believed everything in the Bible, but he had his own methods of arriving at his beliefs. He was of the advanced school of thinkers, and applied natural laws to the interpretation of all miracles, somewhat on the plan of the people who make the 6 days of creation 6 geological epochs, and so forth. Without being aware of it, he was a rather severe satirist on modern scientific religionists. Such a man as I have been describing is rabidly fond of disquisition and argument. One knows that without being told it. One trip the captain had a clergyman on board, but did not know he was a clergyman, since the passenger list did not betray the fact. He took a great liking to this Rev. Mr. Peters, and talked with him a great deal. Told him yarns, gave him toothsome scraps of personal history, and wove a glittering streak of profanity through his garrulous fabric that was refreshing to a spirit weary of the dull neutralities of undecorated speech. One day the captain said, "Peters, do you ever read the Bible?" Apostrophe, "Well, yes." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "I judge it ain't often, by the way you say it. Now, you tackle it in dead earnest once, and you'll find it'll pay. Don't you get discouraged, but hang right on. First you won't understand it, but by and by things will begin to clear up, and then you wouldn't lay it down to carrot ear." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Yes, I have heard that said." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "And it's so too. There ain't a book that begins with it. It lays over 'em all, Peters. There's some pretty tough things in it, there ain't any getting around that, but you stick to them, and think them out, and when once you get on the inside everything's plain as day." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "The miracles too, Captain?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Yes, sir, the miracles too. Every one of them. Now, there's that business with the prophets of Baal, like enough that stumped you?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Well, I don't know, but apostrophe, own up now, it stumped you. Well, I don't wonder. You hadn't any experience in raveling such things out, and naturally it was too many for you. Would you like to have me explain that thing to you, and show you how to get at the meat of these matters?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Indeed, I would, Captain, if you don't mind." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Then the captain proceeded as follows. I'll do it with pleasure. First, you see, I read, and thought, till I got to understand what sort of people they were in the old Bible times, and then after, that it was clear and easy. Now, this was the way I put it up, concerning Isaac 1, and the prophets of Baal. There was some mighty sharp men amongst the public characters of that old ancient day, and Isaac was one of them. Isaac had his failings, plenty of them too. It ain't for me to apologize for Isaac. He played a cold deck on the prophets of Baal, and like enough he was justifiable, considering the odds, that was against him. No, all I say it, t want any miracle, and that I'll show you so's t you can see it yourself." Well, times had been getting rougher and rougher for prophets, that is, prophets of Isaac's denomination. There were 450 prophets of Baal in the community, and only one Presbyterian. That is, if Isaac was a Presbyterian, which I reckon he was, but it don't say. Naturally, the prophets of Baal took all the trade. Isaac was pretty low-spirited, I reckon, but he was a good deal of a man, and no doubt he went a-prophesying around, letting on to be doing a land office business, but he wasn't any use. He couldn't run any opposition to amount to anything. By and by things got desperate with him. He sets his head to work and thinks it all out, and then what does he do? Why, he begins to throw out hints that the other parties are this and that and t'other, nothing very definite, maybe, but just kind of undermining their reputation in a quiet way. This made talk, of course, and finally got to the king. The king asked Isaac what he meant by his talk. Says Isaac, "Oh, nothing particular, only, can they pray down fire from heaven on an altar? It ain't much, maybe, your majesty, only can they do it? That's the idea. So the king was a good deal disturbed, and he went to the prophets of Baal, and they said, pretty airy, that if he had an altar ready, they were ready, and they intimated he better get it insured too. So next morning all the children of Israel, and their parents and the other people gathered themselves together. Well, here was that great crowd of prophets of Baal packed together on one side, and Isaac walking up and down all alone on the other, putting up his job. When time was called, Isaac led on to be comfortable and indifferent, told the other team to take the first innings. So they went at it, the whole 450, praying around the altar, very hopefully, and doing their level best. They prayed an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and so on, plumb till noon. It wasn't any use. They hadn't took a trick. Of course they felt kind of ashamed before all those people, and well they might. Now, what would a magnanimous man do? Keep still, wouldn't he? Of course. What did Isaac do? He graveled the prophets of Baal every way he could think of. Says he, you don't speak up loud enough. Your God's asleep, like enough, or maybe he's taking a walk. You want to holler, you know, or words to that effect. I don't recollect the exact language. Mind, I don't apologize for Isaac. He had his faults. Well, the prophets of Baal prayed along the best they knew how all the afternoon, and never raised a spark. At last, about sundown, they were all tuckered out, and they owned up and quit. What does Isaac do now? He steps up, and says to some friends of his, there, pour 4 barrels of water on the altar. Everybody was astonished, for the other side had prayed at it dry, you know, and got whitewashed. They poured it on. Says he, heave on 4 more barrels. Then he says, heave on 4 more. 12 barrels, you see, all together. The water ran all over the altar, and all down the sides, and filled up a trench around it that would hold a couple of hogsheads easers, it says. I reckon it means about a hogshead. Some of the people were going to put on their things and go, for they allowed he was crazy. They didn't know Isaac. Isaac knelt down, and began to pray. He strung along, and strung along, about the heathen in distant lands, and about the sister churches, and about the state and the country at large, and about those that's in authority in the government, and all the usual program, you know, till everybody had got tired and gone to thinking about something else, and then, all of a sudden, when nobody was noticing, he outs with a match, and rakes it on the underside of his leg, and PFF. Up the whole thing blazes like a house of fire. 12 barrels of water? Petroleum, sir, petroleum. That's what it was. Apostrophe, petroleum, captain? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, sir. The country was full of it. Isaac knew all about that. He read the Bible. Don't you worry about the tough places. They ain't tough when you come to think them out and throw light on them. There ain't a thing in the Bible, but what is true, all you want is to go prayerfully to work, and cipher out how it was done. Apostrophe, apostrophe, one, this is the captain's own mistake. Stirring times in Austria, I the government in the frying pan. Here in Vienna in these closing days of 1897 one's blood gets no chance to stagnate. The atmosphere is brimful of political electricity. All conversation is political, every man is a battery, with brushes overworn, and gives out blue sparks, when you set them going on the common topic. Everybody has an opinion, and lets you have it frank and hot, and out of this multitude of counsel you get merely confusion and despair. For no one really understands this political situation, or can tell you what is going to be the outcome of it. Things have happened here recently which would set any country but Austria on fire from end to end, and upset the government to a certainty, but no one feels confident that such results will follow here. Here, apparently, one must wait and see what will happen, then he will know, and not before. Guessing is idle. Guessing cannot help the matter. This is what the wise tell you. They all say it. They say it every day, and it is the sole detail upon which they all agree. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.